Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palka reporting. Afghans take to the streets of Kabul to protest Islamic State. Afghan security forces fire warning shots to disperse angry protesters in Kabul after some of them tried to storm the gate of the presidential palace. Demonstrators were in the capital protesting the beheading earlier this week of seven civilians, including three women, by militants allegedly linked to Islamic State. Ayaz Ghul files this report from Islamabad.
The victims were members of the minority Shiite Hazara ethnic community. They were kidnapped by IS insurgents more than a month ago, and authorities found their headless corpses Sunday in the southern Zabul province. The violence sparked outrage across Afghanistan, leading to the massive protest rally. The demonstrators carrying the coffins marched through the streets of Kabul despite heavy rain and cold weather before gathering in front of the presidential palace. The protesters chanted anti-government slogans and demanded President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah step down. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Protesters also chanted down with Taliban and down with Daesh, an Arabic acronym for Islamic State. Syria's military reports it has taken back a northern airbase that was under siege by Islamic State for 2 years. State-run television says Syrian forces entered Kuiris Air Base in Aleppo on Tuesday after nearly a month-long offensive. It says the military success was made possible by support from Russian airstrikes. This is VOA News. A two-day international forum on peace and security in Africa ended with U.S. Africa Command's Deputy for Military Operations, Vice Admiral Michael Franken, predicting the eventual demise of the Nigerian insurgent group Boko Haram.
I believe that we will see, perhaps not a few months from now, but 6 months from now, a significant degradation in that scourge, which is Boko Haram.
The U.S. has provided troops to help gather intelligence on ways to defeat the Sunni militant group, and it cautioned that success will depend on how effectively the underlying causes of the insurgency, insecurity, and instability are addressed. A multinational regional force is being assembled to defeat Boko Haram. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has sworn in a 36-member cabinet that includes himself as the country's Minister of Petroleum. The ceremony Wednesday in Abuja came more than 5 months after Mr. Buhari was inaugurated on May the 29th. The president said he wanted to avoid mistakes of the past and find the right person for each job. Mr. Buhari said he will maintain overall control of the key oil sector. Now, Nigeria is Africa's biggest oil producer, pumping more than 2 million barrels per day, and exports provide the bulk of the federal government's revenue. For more information on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. Today in the U.S., we call it Veterans Day, a day set aside originally to honor the members of the military who served in World War I, today being the anniversary of the 1918 armistice that ended that conflict. It has since been expanded to embrace veterans of all wars, including Iraq and Afghanistan. Elsewhere in the world, it's called Remembrance Day. Now, this is Chaplain Padre Colin MacLeod of the Royal Highland Fusiliers 2nd Battalion. That's the Royal Regiment of Scotland, who is serving in Afghanistan as one of the NATO forces.
I think the 11th of November has a lot to say to us about the justice of a cause, why so many have given their lives in the service of their countries, here in Afghanistan in particular, and across the world. And we remember that, above all, it was to defend the weak and protect the helpless.
Special tokens of appreciation will take place along with the traditional and somber observances, including the laying of a wreath by President Barack Obama at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery, just across the Potomac River from the nation's capital. Once again, for more on all of these stories, do visit our website at voanews.com. This is Joe Palka reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations Children's Fund is warning that up to 11 million children in East and Southern Africa are at risk from hunger, disease, and water shortages as a result of this year's strengthening El Niño weather phenomenon. Kenya and Uganda are bracing for floods, while South Africa and Malawi are already grappling with drought.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting. Details coming up.
Also, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has sworn in a 36-member cabinet that includes himself as the country's Minister of Petroleum. And the once expansive and vital Lake Chad has lost as much as 90% of its water in the past 50 years.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the EU began a two-day summit today on the island of Malta to address the migrant and refugee crisis. Member states are expected to offer about $2 billion in development aid to the African countries, which are the source of thousands of people who arrived in Europe this year. The EU was also discussing what to do about African migrants and refugees who do not qualify for asylum. Meanwhile, Austria predicts that more than 95,000 migrants will pass through its borders and move on to Germany, Sweden, and other EU countries this year. But Austria's interior minister says a growing number of migrants are deciding to stay in Austria. Also, the Slovenian military continues to construct razor wire fencing along the river border with Croatia. Officials want to block migrant passage because they fear Austrian officials will slow or stop migrants from entering their country and cause a backup in Slovenia. The president of Italy's Chamber of Deputies criticized Slovenia's effort to stop migrants with the new fence. Laura Baldrini said the EU needs to protect, not defend, against the arriving migrants. And Turkey says 7 children are among 14 migrants who drowned when their boat sank today in the Aegean.
The French news agency reports police and military in Burundi are searching neighborhoods controlled by the political opposition for weapons. UN, US officials and others have warned about escalating violence in the country and the potential for ethnic conflict. However, Burundi's foreign minister told the UN Security Council Monday that his country is not in flames.
The United Nations Children's Fund is warning that up to 11 million children in East and Southern Africa are at risk from hunger, disease, and water shortages as a result of this year's strengthening El Niño weather phenomenon. Kenya and Uganda are bracing for floods, while South Africa and Malawi are already grappling with drought. VOA's Jill Craig takes a closer look at El Niño and the impact this event in the Pacific can have on Africa.
Onesimus Wariri, principal meteorologist at the Kenya Meteorological Department, remembers when El Niño hit in 1997 and 1998, years considered the strongest El Niño on record since 1950, when scientists began recording reliable observations.
There was a lot of rain all over the whole country, which led to destruction of infrastructure, flooding, diseases, loss of lives. So 97 was a serious El Niño.
In 2015 is expected to be another serious El Niño, he says. El Niño is a warming of the central and equatorial parts of the Pacific Ocean. It occurs roughly every 2 to 7 years and can have major effects on weather around the globe, according to Tom DiLiberto, a meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Washington, D.C.
When you see this anomalous warming of the ocean temperatures, it can kind of shift around where or how the atmosphere works in the tropics, which can kind of lead to a domino effect affecting weather and climate patterns really far away from the tropical Pacific Ocean.
During an El Niño event, East African countries tend to have heavy rainfall, while Southern Africa, along with Australia and Indonesia, usually experience dryness, even drought and wildfires. Ruiri explains.
What happens is that during El Niño, the weather pattern changes. And for East Africa, we have very warm equatorial Indian Ocean. And if Indian Ocean is very warm, due to evaporation of the ocean water, we have that water blown to the continental East Africa. And that's why we have a lot of rain in East Africa. But to the south, that denies them the moisture. So it tends to be dry in the southern Africa.
But the predictions don't always come true. In 1997, for instance, expected dry conditions in southern Africa never materialized. For all its potential for destruction, El Nino may bring some benefits too.
Like in northeastern Kenya, it has been very dry. So we expect this rain. The community there can dig dams to harvest that water. We expect pasture to rejuvenate.
Di Liberto says this year could be the third strongest El Nino on record, but that determination cannot be made until early to mid-2016, when all the data is analyzed. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Recent torrential rains could result in large swarms of locusts developing in Northwest Africa, the Horn of Africa, and Yemen. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says those regions must be closely monitored over the next 6 months. The rains create the perfect breeding ground for desert locusts. Swarms can fly up to 150 kilometers a day. Keith Kressman is a senior locust forecasting officer for the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. From Rome, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about why there's a potential locust threat.
We've had a lot of very unusual rainfall, unusual in the sense that it's been very heavy for this time of year, and it's fallen in quite widespread areas. Rains in the end of October in northwest Africa, mainly northern Mauritania and adjacent areas of western Sahara, southern Morocco, and western Algeria. And then earlier this month, and just in the past 10 days, there have been two cyclones that have come through and brought heavy rains to the southern Arabian Peninsula and to the northern part of Somalia.
Now, have these heavy rains and storms been associated with the El Nino phenomenon?
Certainly, the two cyclones that developed in the Arabian Sea are associated with a phenomenon that's probably linked to El Nino. It's worthwhile to note that this year, in September, the waters in the western part of the Arabian Sea were the warmest on record. So this is one of the explanations that meteorologists have indicated as a cause of these two very unusual cyclones.
What about in northwestern Africa?
Northwestern Africa, it's a bit harder to actually say that this is attributed to El Nino. This was just an unusual rainfall event that happened to occur. Some areas received rainfall in a couple of days that normally they would not get in more than a year or so.
So explain why this could result in destructive swarms of locusts developing.
Locusts require rainfall for a couple of different reasons. The rainfall produces a moist soil, the sandy soils that the locusts need to lay their eggs, and after a couple of weeks, those eggs, they will hatch. The rainfall also makes the annual vegetation, turns it green, and the locusts need this annual vegetation for food and for shelter. So when you have this combination of good rainfall, moist soil, and green vegetation, then you have the potential for locust breeding. And we have to keep in mind that locusts increase about 20-fold every generation. So if a generation lasts about 3 months, so after half a year, we can be facing two generations of breeding and more than 500 times the locusts that we started with.
And that's enough for a swarm?
Certainly, yes, that's enough for a swarm. Normally, it takes two consecutive generations of breeding. So if the conditions are good, that could happen within a period of 6 months before good swarms can form.
Give us an idea of how many locusts are in a typical swarm.
There are billions and billions of locusts in a typical swarm. We take an example, say the swarm the size of Manhattan in New York. That swarm in one day could potentially eat the same amount of food that everybody would eat in Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey.
Now, I understand that these swarms would follow the wind. So what areas would be most affected if these swarms develop?
Well, if the swarms develop, mainly they're going to stay in place. As long as vegetation is green, the soil is moist. So that means we're expecting that locusts could be present in these areas of heavy rainfall probably for the next 6 months or so until about next spring. when those conditions do become dry, you know that the desert locust has this great capacity to just simply pick up and move to greener pastures. So it would have to first see how successful the breeding was, what level of breeding, and then we can make a better estimation of where they might move to.
Now, is there enough money for the monitoring and possible follow-up programs to eradicate the locusts? I mean, we saw what happened in Madagascar when not enough money was provided and those swarms developed into a plague.
Well, the situation, of course, in the desert locust countries is far different than that in Madagascar, mainly because FAO has been working with these countries for nearly five decades. And we've been strengthening gradually our capacity to not only monitor the locusts and report them on time, but also to undertake the necessary control operations when they find significant populations. So these countries are much better prepared and ready to tackle locust problems. But, of course, these are some of the poorest countries in the world. So sometimes those locusts will just simply overwhelm the countries in terms of the resources that are available to manage them. At that point, then, FAO will step in an emergency capacity and work with the international donor community in order to supplement control operations that are needed. Just because that there's heavy, unusual rainfall doesn't automatically mean there's been a locust emergency. There have been cyclones and heavy rains in the past, and the locusts just simply didn't respond. But on the other hand, there have been cyclones that have led to development of locust plagues. So we take these events very, very seriously.
Keith Cressman is a senior locust forecasting officer for the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. From Rome, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The EU began a two-day summit today on the island on Malta to address the migrant and refugee crisis. And Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has sworn in 36-member cabinet that includes himself as the country's Minister of Petroleum. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 1630 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more. Coming up next, right here on The Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has finally unveiled appointments of 36 cabinet ministers. Among major positions, Mr. Buhari has named a former banker from Ogun State in the south as finance minister. He named the members of his cabinet many weeks ago, but delayed identifying their individual responsibilities until today. Mr. Buhari is keeping tight personal control of the corruption-plagued Nigerian National Oil Corporation and identified the head of the state oil firm as his deputy. The Minister of Industry is a man who headed Nigeria's biggest private equity firm. The former governor of Lagos State was named Minister of Power, Works and Housing.
Protesters in southeastern Nigeria are demanding the release of the jailed head of a radio station that advocates for restoration of the nation of Biafra and its independence from Nigeria. A civil war over the self-styled Republic of Biafra ended in 1970, but the cause has persisted for decades and remains a sensitive issue. Christine reports from Lagos on the pro-Biafra movement's insurgence in recent years.
Protesters from the Indigenous Peoples of Biafra organization took to city streets in Nigeria's south-south and southeast regions this week, calling for the release of Nnamdi Kanu, director of Radio Biafra. He was arrested last month by Nigeria's secret police. A spokesman for the agency could not be located, but local media reports say Kanu was charged with offenses related to his station's broadcasts. A spokesman for the IPOB chapter in southeastern Anambra State, Uguchukwu Chinwuba, says the goal is independence.
We don't want to be Nigeria anymore. We want to be on our own.
45 years after the end of the Civil War, Chinwuba says people in the southeast have not benefited from being part of Africa's most populous country.
Everyone would know that what Nigeria have, like crude oil or resources of anything, comes from Biafra land. And we do not benefit anything else.
Sporadic pro-Biafra rallies over the past few years occasionally have led to arrests. The government banned Radio Biafra in July. Laja Odukoya, a lecturer in political science at the University of Lagos, says the protests are a symptom of Nigeria's economic problems. Like much of the rest of Nigeria, rates of unemployment and poverty are high in the southeast.
Biafra, for me, it's not necessarily a situation whereby you have a secession in this state, but calling attention to the dysfunctionalism within the state and the need to redress it.
The Biafran War remains a dark and controversial chapter of Nigeria's history. The three-year conflict killed over 1 million people, many of them from starvation. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Once expansive and vital, Lake Chad has lost as much as 90% of its water in the past 50 years. Experts from the six member states of the Lake Chad Basin Commission met in Cameroon to put together a plan to save the lake that will be presented at the Paris Climate Change Summit in December. Moki Edwin Kenzeka has the story from Yaoundé.
The proposal from regional experts meeting in Yaoundé this week is to transfer water from the majestic 3.7 million square kilometer Congo River Basin to the vanishing Lake Chad River Basin. The Congo River Basin is the second largest in the world after the Amazon River. Experts say that could improve the lives of over 40 million people in the countries that surround Lake Chad: Chad, Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Nigeria, Niger, and Libya. Swaibu Mohammed, environmental expert at the Lake Chad Basin Commission, urges world leaders meeting in Paris to take the proposal seriously. He says the neighboring Congo River Basin has enough water to help.
Le lac Tchad faisait 25 000 km² au cours des années 1960. En 1960, la population...
He says Lake Tchad's surface area has reduced by 90% from 25,000 square kilometers in 1960. But he says the population depending on the lake for their livelihoods has increased from 3.5 million to over 40 million inhabitants. He says that is not including the animals, plants and birds that also exert pressure on the disappearing lake. For the water transfer project to go forward, the governments of the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Central African Republic, and the Republic of Congo must allow the Lake Chad Basin Commission to use their territories and water resources. The experts say they await the green light in Paris. The project would cost $14.5 billion. No funding is currently available. Deepening poverty around Lake Chad is also linked to regional insecurity, in particular the cross-border expansion of militant Nigerian sect Boko Haram. Mana Bubakari, representative of the executive secretary of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, says the commission also plans to canvass donors for $80 million to create jobs for youths.
Les jeunes de ce bassin et particulièrement autour de ce lac Tchad, c'est des jeunes qui sont...
Bubakari says young people in the Lake Tchad basin are joining the Boko Haram terrorist group because of lack of jobs and difficult economic conditions resulting from the drying up of the lake and the extinction of its resources that should have created livelihoods for them. The drying up of Lake Chad has been attributed to changing weather patterns and human activity. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Cape Town, anti-riot police fired stun gun grenades at striking employees at the South African Parliament today. This is the third day of a strike by Parliament employees demanding higher wages. Most official business in Parliament has been shut down during the strike by the National Education, Health and Allied Workers Union. In other news, a South African judge has sentenced 8 Johannesburg policemen to 15 years in prison for murder. They were charged in 2013 with the death of a Mozambican cab driver who died in police custody. Evidence indicated the cab driver suffered serious injuries when the officers beat him in his cell. The judge called their actions barbaric.
Aid agencies say there's a need to find long-term solutions for nearly 200,000 displaced people living in camps in the DRC. 3 camps were closed in the DRC's North Kivu province last month, and as Nick Long reports from the provincial capital Goma, there likely are to be more closures despite continuing insecurity in some areas.
The great majority of the estimated 700,000 displaced people in North Kivu are not living in camps and not receiving food aid. Nevertheless, donors are getting tired of paying for the more than 50 camps in the province, says Ben Adua, a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration in North Kivu. The donors have been funding the same things for a long time and funds are getting short, he told reporters. Part of the reason for donor fatigue is the realization that the number of people in the camps was exaggerated. Last year, after nighttime checks were carried out at 31 sites in North Kivu, the numbers at those sites were found to be two-thirds lower than initial estimates, according to a joint report by the organisations managing the camps in North Kivu. Some of that reduction would have been due to improved security, enabling people to return home, but the report clearly suggests that another reason was inflated figures. This year, 5 camps near Goma have been closed, and the people there have mostly returned to their home villages or resettled in areas near Goma. VOA spoke to a formerly displaced person, Jean-Pierre Habugimana, who left the Lac Vert camp near Goma last month and returned to his village, Kimoka. He told VOA he's very happy to be back home because people did not eat well at the camp and washing was difficult, whereas life is much better in his village. He adds that he wants to thank the organisations who help the returnees, but they also need tools like machetes and hoes, as well as seeds for farming. His neighbour, Faraka Songo, is vice president of the group of people from the Lac Vert camp who have moved to Kimoka. She tells VOA she and her family were promised seeds that have not yet arrived, and that makes life difficult for them because they depend on agriculture for their food. The seed distribution is the responsibility of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and was supposed to have happened by the middle of last month. Ben Adua of the International Organization for Migration told VOA it's been delayed. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
When news is happening,
VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The EU begins a two-day summit today on the island of Malta to address the migrant and refugee crisis. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari swears in a 36-member cabinet that includes himself as the country's Minister of Petroleum. And the once expansive and vital Lake Chad has lost as much as 90% of its water in the past 50 years. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, for the first time in history, the International Olympic Committee will allow refugees who cannot compete for a country to compete under the Olympic flag. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with, once again, African football.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, big week in African football. 40 national teams playing first leg fixtures in the qualifying competition for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. On Wednesday evening, two matches, one in Mozambique and the other in Sudan. Mozambique hosting Gabon and Sudan playing the 2012 Nations Cup champion Zambia. How do you see these matches, David?
Well, the one in Mozambique is going to be interesting, Sonny, because we've got Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Now, on the Sunny Side of Sport, we're always talking about the goals he's scoring in the Bundesliga. 14 already this season, an amazing achievement. And now he's going to be wearing the colors of the national team of Gabon. They're known as the Panthers. They're in Maputo to play a Mozambican side that have not been doing particularly well recently. If you use the recent Cup of Nations as a yardstick, Sonny, they lost at home to Rwanda, and then they lost away to Mauritius. Now, that is unimpressive form indeed. Whatever the results in Maputo of the first leg, I think over the two legs, I would certainly expect Gabon to qualify on goal aggregate. And particular interest, I think, will be in the performance of Aubameyang. We've seen sometimes in the past players doing very well in Europe and then they just don't shine with their national team. And on the other hand, some players, of course, not doing particularly well in Europe, they come and play for the national team and do extremely well. But Aubameyang's got a good record, both for Borussia Dortmund in his club career and also for Gabon. He scores the majority of the Gabonese goals, so we'll watch him with interest. The other match, Sonny, Zambia way up in Sudan. Now, as I speak to you, there's an absolute heat wave in South Africa with temperatures touching 100 degrees Fahrenheit. One thing I know about Sudan, a phrase I often use to describe Khartoum, is sauna-like. I know it's steaming up there. And you'd never play football during the day. They only play football at night. It's unfortunate because what it means is a lot of extra expenses with floodlights, etc. But it would be humanly impossible to play in Sudan in the middle of the day. So that's going to be a bit of a challenge for Zambia. But Sudan, like Mozambique, have not been doing well of late, despite the fact that they're two best clubs. Al Hilal and Al Merrikh did very well in their just completed CAF Champions League. They both reached the semi-finals, and many of the best players from both clubs will no doubt be in the national squad. But again, Sonny, looking at this over two legs, and all these matches are home-and-away affairs, you would certainly have to fancy the Zambian side struggling to match the expectations that were raised by what you mentioned, that famous 2012 Cup of Nations success. Since then, it's been a little bit downhill for the Chipolo Polo, which translated means the copper bullets. Those bullets have been firing since, Sonny, but not with the same accuracy. Nevertheless, I'm predicting with reasonable confidence that it will be Gabon and Zambia over the two legs who will win these ties. Interesting to look at the rankings of the sides. The difference between Gabon and Mozambique is 52 places on the world rankings in favor of the Gabonese. And it's even wider between Zambia and Sudan. Zambia are 57 places higher. So according to me, Sonny, which is most important, and also according to the FIFA rankings, it's going to be Gabon and Zambia. If I get either of those wrong, it's going to be an awful lot of omelette flying towards me.
David, what do Thursday's 2018 World Cup qualifiers look like in Africa?
On Thursday, Sonny, we've got five matches. We've got Burundi at home to DR Congo, Namibia at home to Guinea, Benin at home to Burkina Faso, Togo at home to Uganda, and I can think of at least one Voice of America staffer who'll be following that match with great interest. And Morocco at home to Equatorial Guinea. And let's look at all five matches, Sonny. Well, Burundi against DR Congo, that's a real Central African battle. You would fancy DR Congo, again, I stress, over two legs. What home advantage does for the underdogs in the first leg, it gives them a chance to create a shock and build some sort of a lead going into the return match. But surely over two legs, I think the Congolese will be too strong for the Burundians. Namibia and Guinea, I think it's the same story, Sonny. You would have to fancy Guinea here. Namibia won the Southern Africa Championship last May, and there were high hopes that they would do well. But since then, they haven't really been able to build on that success. They lost away to Niger and at home to Senegal in Cup of Nations qualifiers. Guinea, they haven't been setting the world alight either. They suffered a shock home defeat in Casablanca. They played there because of the Ebola epidemic to Swaziland. And then they went to Harare, took the lead against Zimbabwe, and then conceded a very soft goal for a 1-1 draw. But nevertheless, I stress over two legs, one would fancy the Guineans, who are 65 places above the Namibians on the world rankings. And just briefly going back to the Congo-Burundi game, Congo 52 places higher than the Burundians. There are, however, some matches where the rankings indicate a real closeness. And one of those is Benin against Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso are only 10 places higher than Benin. And this West African showdown, Burkina Faso have not been doing particularly well of late. You know, we talked about Zambia, Sonny, not building on their 2012 Cup of Nations success. Exactly the same comments apply to Burkina Faso, who stunned everybody, me especially, by reaching the 2013 Cup of Nations final. They came into that tournament with an awful record. You assumed that they were going to be knocked out after the first round. But lo and behold, they went all the way to the final. And in the final, they gave the Super Eagles of Nigeria a good run for their money. A lone goal scored by Sunday Mbah just before halftime, giving the Super Eagles victory. So again, there were expectations that Burkina Faso would build on that. And sure enough, in the World Cup qualifiers that followed, they got all the way to the playoffs before losing on the away goal rule to Algeria, who turned out to be the best African performers at the 2014 World Cup. So things were looking rosy for Burkina Faso. But all of a sudden, it's all gone a bit pear-shaped. And I'm giving them the edge over Burkina Faso, but I'm doing it, Sonny, with a little bit of hesitancy. I think this one is going to be tight, tight. Now, we mentioned Togo and Uganda, and Uganda, of course, I'm sure Douglas is listening, Sonny. He probably doesn't need much reminding that Uganda have not reached the Cup of Nations since 1978. And their latest attempt, Sonny, was going quite well for the 2015 finals until they came up against the Togolese. The Togolese went to Kampala. They won there. The sides met again in Lome, and Togo won again. So to put it mildly, the Ugandans have a lot of revenge to catch up on when they face the Togolese Sparrowhawks. Togo are no great shakes, and at the moment their star player, Emmanuel Adebayor, is in one of his regular retirement phases. He retires and comes back, then he retires again and comes back again. And at the moment, it's a very sad story, Sonny. He's a talented footballer. He's a former African Footballer of the Year, but he fell out badly at Tottenham Hotspur, and eventually they basically just kicked him out of the club. And it seems as if nobody wants to touch this player. I think the view is he's got a lot of talent, but he's just too much trouble. And he has his own issues, which he has spoken about on social media. But for the moment, anyway, he's not part of the Togolese setup. And I'm going to give the vote this time, Sonny, to Uganda. I think as long as they can get a good result in Lome, I think it's expecting too much maybe for the Cranes to win there. But perhaps a score draw, that would be a satisfactory result, and put them in good fettle for the return match in Kampala. Morocco and Equatorial Guinea is an interesting tie because it brings together the side that should have hosted the 2015 Cup of Nations and the side that actually did. Now, what happened is Morocco, a long time ago, were chosen to host the Cup of Nations. But getting close to the event itself, which happened last January and February, they got cold feet. And their big concern was that some supporters from some of the qualifying countries could have brought the Ebola epidemic into the country. And that, apart from the human issue, Sonny, would have wreaked havoc with tourism. Now, in Morocco, as in most North African countries, tourism is a vital part of the economy. We're seeing the effects of problems in Tunisia and more recently in Egypt, where tourism is, I cannot stress how important it is. And the Moroccans clearly decided that the tourist industry was more vital even than a football tournament. So they pulled out and they got suspended. And then at the last minute, with just 60 days to go to the kickoff, Equatorial Guinea came to the rescue. So I think there's going to be an interesting bite to this match. And this is another game with just 10 places between the teams. Equatorial Guinea are ranked 69th in the world and Morocco 79th. And that shows you that the Moroccans have dropped off quite a bit. They are, after all, a team that have qualified four times for the World Cup. So from those Thursday matches, looking at the ties over two legs, I'm going for DR Congo, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Uganda, and Morocco.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a photo of Liberia-born Darlington Nagbe of Major League Soccer's Portland Timbers Club. Darlington became a U.S. citizen in September, and the USA's German coach, Jurgen Klinsmann, quickly took note of that. He named Nagbe to his squad for upcoming World Cup qualifiers against St. Vincent and the Grenadines and Trinidad and Tobago. Darlington Nagbe, congratulations to being on the U.S. men's national soccer team. In more Major League Soccer news, Orlando City striker Kyle Larin has been named the Rookie of the Year. The 20-year-old Canadian scored a MLS rookie record 17 goals in 27 matches during the regular season for Orlando City, which is one of the league's new expansion clubs. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a Mandela Fellow in the Young African Leadership working in America and Tanzania. And next, for the first time in history, the International Olympic Committee will allow refugees who cannot compete for a country to compete under the Olympic flag. But first, some music. Here is the All Out group from Sierra Leone with AAO.
Big girl girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake while they rap. Baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake.
Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl, with the pretty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I said I'm for sure, make you see where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
Baby girl, with the pretty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
Move your body, move, move, move your body. Don't move, I'm go up, shake and back, calm down. Yeah, with the rock your body, rock your body. Left arm hidden like never before. For the girl, them, demand them. The drinks you can't fall, take over. Put your hands up, I not the air, make a no say. You know if I ever tire.
I don't talk, say, look now, me head don't block. The way you the dress, now the way we the talk. DJ play the song, make me go non-stop. From night till the morning, the door, no the lock. Die day, some man say, die no day. I look around, say, no sign no day. But try day, I pass. See, no way, no way. Tony Flex, Arayaji, man, and Lil J.
Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I said I for sure make you see where they make you they dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I said I for sure make you see where they make you they dance.
So what is rap? Baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake. What is rap? Baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake.
Hey, hey. Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I said I'm for sure, make you see where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I said I'm for sure, make you see where they make you dance.
The rap slam now for grab and clap. With a kick up tonight, even if it's crap. Holy girl, I gonna make it do young two step. Show the other one, them still not regret. Make it dance, make you sweat, no go regret. Come on, I don't puff, puff, like you cigarette. In the J's, Sarah, I J-Man, no so rookie. You the act like Bobo, gonna host, you not be. We give them R&B, we give them hip hop. The one that with the talk, now them what you zip up. Show me the team, we make you move like a snake, man. Me and you tonight, the rules and the break, man.
Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I said I for sure make you see where they make you they dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I said I for sure make you see where they make you they dance.
So what is rap? Baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake. While they rap? Baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake.
Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
Set up for show, make you see where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I set up for show, make you see where they make you dance.
From Sierra Leone, WIA.
A Mandela Fellow from Tanzania is in the Young African Leadership Initiative, worked with U.S. National Park employees on control of wild population of bears at Yosemite National Park in the state of California. Back home, he tries to control elephant poachers. Lazaro Michael Tipap is head of the anti-poaching unit at the Selous Game Reserve in Tanzania. He told VOA's Esther Gitui about working in America and in Tanzania.
My name is Lazaro Michael Tipap from Tanzania, and this is El Capitan, the highest rock in North America. This yearly program helped me, it broadened my knowledge, first of all.
See you later.
Hey. It also gave me a lot of experience and kind of very nice skills on leadership.
Today we'll be kind of doing patrol, mostly looking on location of bears, using the tracking devices that we have, like telemetry.
The early fellowship has been so much important because, first of all, it just kind of opened me and gave me a lot of networking, not only from the American people, but with also African, fellow African people.
Why we are doing this? We are doing this because it is very important, because if bears go on eating food, human food, they'll become problems. So we avoid these things because actually if we start habituating bears, they'll change in their normal habit and become totally problem animals. What I do back home there is mostly we do kind of anti-poaching activities like supervised patrol groups with rangers inside and outside the protected areas. We do kind of ecological monitoring, and so we also give conservation education to the local people that surround the park.
If I check now, this park like Yosemite is 125 years old. But 150 years ago, the same thing was happening that what is happening in Africa, okay? So, but the government used a lot of power, used a lot of resources to educate people and try to help people and develop people. At the end of the day now, these parks are free and they are safe, and you can see everybody who is coming here is enjoying. So those things are possible if only government will now start thinking about the local people that surround the parks.
This yearly program helped me is it broadened my knowledge, first of all. It also gave me a lot of experience and kind of very nice skills on leadership.
But the day that I was told, I was called by the embassy that I'm one of the people that was selected. I was very much excited. I didn't believe that. So yeah, at the end of the day, I say, okay, I did it also. So I'm doing great thing. If at least people have seen what I'm doing. So I was very much excited.
That was Mandela fellow Lazaro Michael Tipap talking about his work at Yosemite National Park.
For the first time in history, the International Olympic Committee will allow refugees who cannot compete for a country to compete under the Olympic flag. But they have to qualify first. The IOC decision comes as the UN Refugee Agency says worldwide displacement of civilians has hit an all-time high as war and persecution increases. As INBO reports, the new rule could have a big impact on aspiring Olympic athletes from South Sudan.
Loss is a reality that many refugees are all too familiar with. Loss of home, country, and many times, even loved ones. IOC Chief Thomas Bach of Germany says the International Olympic Committee is all too aware of these circumstances, especially for athletes.
Having no national team to belong to, having no flag to march behind, having no national anthem to be played for them, these refugee athletes will be welcomed to the Olympic Games with the Olympic flag and with the Olympic anthem.
Bach made the announcement to the UN General Assembly last week. He also called for a resolution to demand that all UN members recognize a truce during the 2016 Summer Games in Brazil. The resolution, entitled Building a Peaceful and Better World Through Sport and the Olympic Ideal, was supported by 180 out of 193 member states. It calls for the Olympic truce to be respected from 7 days before the start of the Olympic Games until 7 days after the Paralympic Games, which follow the Olympics. Fox says the Olympics symbolize tolerance, solidarity, and peace. South Sudanese marathon runner Gwor Macaire, who ran independently under the Olympic flag in 2012, says that message will resonate strongly with refugees around the world.
It's significant because it gives opportunity. Give opportunity to the refugees, and it gives a hope. That's the thing about the sport and the Olympic, the spirit of the sport.
Macaire, known as the athlete with no country in the 2012 Games, says he personally knows how important this recognition will be to millions of refugees worldwide.
Wherever they go, they will say, okay, I am a refugee and I have opportunity in the international community, and I can compete. I can be an athlete. I can be a world champion with no fear saying I don't have a paperwork. You see, I don't have a nationality and I will not be able to compete. So for the IOC to make such a decision is actually giving a great spirit to all the refugees youth across all over the world.
Macaire says since refugees have faced so much adversity, they are mentally strong. He says the Olympics are an important opportunity for world-class refugee athletes to overcome unimaginable odds.
I'm pretty sure there were a lot, some of them were athletes in their own country. But now with the dilemma and the situation they are in, the Mighty film there, everything is falling apart and there is the end of it. But I would, my message to them is to keep their hope alive and focus.
The 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro will take place from August 5th to the 21st. They will be followed by the Paralympic Games from September 7th to the 18th. Makair has been training in Kenya with other South Sudanese long-distance runners to compete for South Sudan in the 2016 Olympics. For VOA News, I'm Ian Bior in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
During the American Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln called on his countrymen in his famous Gettysburg Address to ensure that liberty shall not perish from the earth. His words have inspired many over the years, including millions in our nation's armed forces, who fought to preserve not only America's freedom, but that of other nations as well. Today, Veterans Day, America pauses to honor these men and women and the values of duty and sacrifice they represent. Long after they leave uniform, they symbolize what it means to be a citizen of a free land. The holiday, observed every year on November 11th, originated with the armistice that ended the First World War in 1918. The conflict, fought in Asia, Africa, scattered islands in the Pacific, and the waters off South America, as well as on the battlefields of Europe, was seen as the war to end all wars. But other wars followed, and in 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower expanded the holiday to honor all who have served in uniform, both in war and peace. Our government continues this effort to this day, with programs to help veterans leaving the military to find employment and ease their transition into civilian life. Honoring this sacred trust with America's veterans means doing all we can to help them find work when they come home, so they never feel as if the American dream they fought to defend is out of reach for them or their families, President Barack Obama said. At its core, though, Veterans Day isn't about war. It commemorates no battlefield victory or defeat. It celebrates no advancement of political or territorial ambition. Rather, it's a day of remembrance, echoing similar holidays in Great Britain, Canada, South Africa, and other nations that honor military veterans for their service and sacrifice.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is facing his toughest challenge yet. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they explore the possibility of major opposition leaders, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and Dr. Kizza Besigye, joining forces in next year's Ugandan poll. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Thank you.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.